Natural Solutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
So this is Natural Solutions with Dr. J, our podcast, and we're very fortunate to be with Monet Lavallee-Garcia today, who is an almost graduate of UC Berkeley in sociology.
Yes, correct.
So she had approached me by email, I think, initially, to find out, to do research on attitudes of other professions regarding alternative medicine.
So it's basically exploring the relationship between stigma and holistic medicine, and that could include sort of anyone. It could include the scientific community, the biomedical community, which is maybe where we see it more often, but it could also be from the general public, personal experiences with family and friends, literature that's been produced by scientific communities. So we sort of see it kind of everywhere, right? It can sort of come from any place. So far I have gotten examples from all of those different places.
So what are some of the examples you've gotten already? And this is for alternative medicine in general. It's not just acupuncture, it could be homeopathy or for other things as well.
Yeah, so that it definitely complicates things given that holistic medicine is such a broad field, right? But I am sort of including all types of holistic medicine. Of course, it depends largely on who is, you know, ends up being a participant with the interviews, right? What sort of methods we get to actually look at. I have had some exposure to the differences in different types, for example. So, for example, chiropractic and acupuncture tend to be sort of, I want to use the correct language here, but maybe more well known, maybe more accepted. There's a lot more research that's been done. You know, we'll see at the end of my paper what I sort of come up with, but my hunch is, my hypothesis is that those particular ones are a lot less stigmatized than others, say, like homeopathy, which is one that, doesn't have insurance coverage for, that's just one marker of sort of how accepted it is. And there's this question of sort of the relationship between accessibility and stigma, right? And I'm sort of exploring that because it kind of has come to this question of the chicken or the egg, like which one comes first, can if we sort of work on one or the other, is it gonna, you know, does it matter which one we look at first?
The accessibility versus stigma, you said?
Yeah, exactly. So what I mean by that is do we have less accessibility to holistic medicine because it's stigmatized, or is it stigmatized because we have less accessibility, right?
Definitely there's a relationship between those two.
Yes, exactly.
I would agree. For example, as a licensed acupuncturist, and having been licensed in California since 83, initially when I first started in the profession, in 1983, there were 5 states that licensed acupuncture. And now I think it's close to 49.
Wow.
So in 30-some years, the barriers to actually practicing professionally with some governmental recognition has taken a long time.
Yes.
So California was one of the first states to recognize that. And it actually came from a lawsuit that a medical doctor sued his own board, which is a rarity, medical doctor suing his board because he wanted to have access to referring out to acupuncturists, because he was finding that the acupuncture was very beneficial for his patients, and then the board all of a sudden said, oh, you can't do that.
Interesting.
So, as is the case in the beginning of most of the state's acceptance, there was a necessity of a medical doctor's referral to acupuncture, if it was even permitted.
Right.
Now, back in 1979 or 78 to 83, I was living in Philadelphia, and I was translating Japanese research on cancer for National Cancer Institute. Yeah. And toward the end of that, I also started studying acupuncture. Now, I'd studied acupuncture when I was traveling in Japan and other parts of Asia in my early 20s, but in order to actually practice legally, I needed to go to a school that was recognized by a state licensing board, etc. So I was on the East Coast, and toward the end of that, this project was being essentially canceled, defunded, the one on cancer. Mm-hmm. And so I was translating research on cancer, and there were other English articles. It was all going into the national database, and so we would do abstracts of the research so that people could do online research. And this was before personal computers, right before personal computers came out. So it was big computers. And so because of my interest in acupuncture, and there was this the whole project was dying, and because we were all going to be laid off, we were given a certain amount of extra time to go out and look for other work. So I was focusing on the acupuncture side of things. And one of the things I discovered was that American Medical Association in Chicago, it has all these different committees. And acupuncture had been illegal from the federal government standpoint because no one really knew why. And so I sort of did some investigation. I did some writing and, you know, researching and writing letters based on the fact I was a senior information analyst for the National Cancer Institute. So I had a certain largesse, a certain, name or authority by writing in those ways. And so I found out that there was a subcommittee of the American Medical Association, and the subcommittee was like the medical devices subcommittee. And so they classified acupuncture needles as experimental devices. Mm-hmm. And because the federal government will not pay, Medicare and all these others won't pay, or no insurance company will pay for experimental procedures. So the AMA had this way of wrecking the possibility of acupuncturists ever to get recognition, because they said, well, acupuncture needles are experimental devices. Right. In spite of the fact they've been used thousands of years, right? So there was a movement at the national level. The Acupuncture Association eventually used contacts or something and got that changed. And so that opened up the possibility for acupuncture to be recognized more at a federal level, because it was no longer an experimental device. I think it was like a control device instead of experimental. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of stigma that can occur. Now, when I moved to California in 83, there was a movement that I found out that the blood banks, now, so back then, that was when AIDS was just becoming well known and an issue, and I helped to found the one of the first Chinese medicine studies of AIDS, co-founded with Susan Black here in Berkeley. And it was called the Immune Enhancement Project. It still exists in San Francisco today. I'm not associated with it, but one of the things that we found was that the blood banks were associating acupuncture with tattoo needling and other things. And so they were refusing to allow people to donate blood if they had acupuncture or if they were having tattoos or if they were IV users or junkies, right? And so all of a sudden there's this stigma that an official, very you know, the Red Cross was saying, oh, well, look at acupuncture. It's this horrible thing.
Right.
So it's like this institutionalized stigmatization. Stigmatization, is that such a word?
Stigmatization.
of acupuncture that was occurring. And so the California chapter of acupuncture, California Acupuncture Association, worked to get the Red Cross to change that. And so these are some examples of an institutionalized thing. No, there's this, I can't remember his name, I should. He's a quackbuster. He self-proclaimed quackbuster at Loma Linda University. And he has constantly, I mean, for years and years, he would write his propaganda, which I call it, saying acupuncture is totally bogus and this and that. And so he's another institutionalized person. And years ago, I think if you go on the internet now, still, he's probably has high SEO rankings. Back then, he was like the first position for anything having to do with acupuncture. So the first thing people were shown on the internet was that acupuncture is quackery,
right,
and homeopathy and all. So this is another example of, now this is someone who has been debunked and his associations with drug companies and things like that have been exposed, etc. He never practiced. He actually isn't even licensed in the state of California. He's an MD, but you can be a medical doctor and yet not have a license to practice. So he never did. But here he is the proponent, and that, you know, saying that all this stuff is like bogus.
Right.
So another great example of earlier years, they created this tone that still is an echo that permeates a certain degree of what's going on.
Totally. Yeah, and that's sort of what brought me to you, right, is that, you know, because there is a lot of scholarship, written work on sort of past, examples of this stigma and
right.
how it's manifested and very clear indications of that. And then recent studies have actually shown that recent studies of very particular groups have shown more favorability towards holistic medicine. And so I went, well, is that true? Like, what, you know, and what's your
right.
real experience, your
right.
real world experience with
right.
this?
So,
you know.
So, there are still people who are skeptical. No. For example, acupuncture, I don't think it can't help everyone with everything.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it makes some really amazing changes in arenas that we go, wow, look at that. That's pretty amazing. How did that happen? I mean, I'm a total believer, but a total disbeliever because I'm very scientific about things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm an empiricist, which is very much what acupuncture came out of,
mm-hmm.
is... figuring out, well, if you put a stick of needle here or whatever, what's going to happen
mm-hmm.
to the body? And because we can understand how acupuncture works in a lot of different ways from a scientific standpoint at a lot of different levels. Electromagnetic influences, we know that it also influences opiate receptors in the brain and enkephalin receptors and substance P, and it decreases inflammation and improves circulatory flow. There are a lot of different studies that have been done that show the mechanisms upon which acupuncture works. So there's a lot of scientific understanding, and yet there's still a lot of things we don't know.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of legitimacy behind it, and the National Institute of Health has its complementary. I don't know if it's an agency or,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
yeah,
they've also done research. And some of the research will say, well, we aren't totally sure if this actually, if we put needles in a particular place, it's going to have an effect. And then they put in needles in other places that aren't official points,
mm-hmm.
and they compare the results.
Right.
And so sometimes it says, well, there wasn't that, you know, statistically significant difference between the two. Now, one of the fascinating things when I first moved out here, there were these articles that people showed that were from the American Journal JAMA, Journal mm-hmm. of American Medical Association, one of those talked about placebo effect. And there was, it was an editorial, which, for example, one MD said, yeah, there's a lot of placebo effect even in what we do.
Right.
But use it.
Right.
I mean, it is very powerful to actually use that. So instead of saying, oh, placebo, get rid of it. It's like, placebo, let's utilize it to help people. But another study, which was, I think, done in the 50s, they were comparing the different ways in which medicines were delivered. And which way was most effective as far as placebo effect. So when we're talking about, let's say, for example, someone, you can, vitamins, okay? So vitamins you could take orally, and there's various ways you could do it. You could do tablets or capsules. You could also inject them, right? So they could be like using a needle, a hypodermic needle or syringe. And so which of those do you think is, those is most, just the way that a medicine or something is delivered, which of those is the most influential placebo effect, do you think? This is medical doctors doing their own research, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you think is the most effective placebo?
I don't know.
Injections. It doesn't matter what you inject.
Interesting.
The actual doing an injection is a much more powerful placebo effect than, say, the second, what do you think would be second most effective? A capsule or a tablet?
Capsule.
Yes, capsules were second place. What color capsule is most effective?
No, I don't know.
Red.
Yeah.
Red capsule.
Interesting. I could definitely see the psychology in that, right? The more invasive sort of it is, right?
The more legitimate it is, my God.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And so that's something that medical doctors actually research themselves. And there was an article about that in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So, but that kind of thing is forgotten, is thrown to the side.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, so one could say, okay, well, is it, you know, is that injection that the person got with whatever is injected, is that, how much is placebo effect?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that sham?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I think, you know, the sophistication on how people operate and people's psychology is very high level in all kinds of industry. And so making tablets in different shapes, I mean, partly that is to distinguish them if, like, you're in an emergency room and you go, oh, what is this? They took too much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, I mean, people could make everything the same shape and the same color.
Right.
But there's psychological things about different colors.
Right.
And so how much of that is sham? Mm-hmm. I like to just turn it back around. I mean, it's like, okay, you think what we're doing is sham. Well, how much is placebo effect a sham?
Yeah, and that sort of brings you to the question of stigma, right? Because if we're willing to accept these things that are within the biomedical paradigm of thought, like, for example, aspirin, right? We had no idea how aspirin worked for years and years and years, but we were like, it works, so take it for pain, right? And yet, here's this other thing, you know, acupuncture or whatever holistic modality that has been working for thousands of years, but because it's not within the biomedical paradigm, it's not sort of accepted in the same way that this pharmaceutical drug was, right?
Yeah, that's true. So in the arena of pain, for example, for acupuncture, certainly if someone is wanting their insurance plan to cover treatment with acupuncture, then a pain diagnosis is the most accepted diagnosis that would be considered legitimate for using acupuncture.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were studies done in Canada in the early 70s after Nixon went to China. There was a reporter who had acute appendicitis, and he had to have acupuncture, or had to have surgery, and so they used acupuncture as part of the surgery. And so that created a lot of buzz about acupuncture. I go, wow, how can you possibly have surgery and use acupuncture for the pain issues? And so research was done in Canada on it, and the research was using naloxone. Naloxone is an opiate antagonist. And so the there were like little mice and stuff, they'd put them on hot pads and they'd run around, and they'd get, you know, the hotter it was, the less they could tolerate it. And so there's only a certain amount of time they could stay on the hot pad, then they had to go off of it. And so then they gave them acupuncture and they could stand on the hot pad longer.
Interesting.
And so then they injected them with naloxone after that, and then they couldn't stand on it as long. It was back to normal. So that, because naloxone is an opiate antagonist, the opiate receptors in our brain, the natural ones, were being blocked, but the acupuncture enhanced the pain tolerance that people had because it increased the ability to increase those opiate receptors. And so that's how acupuncture, right at the beginning, was known to have anti-pain properties because of its effect on the opiates in the brain.
Right.
And so that became sort of a standard. Okay, well, we have to kind of accept the fact that this research was done and we've replicated it. And so insurance companies will say, yeah, I guess, you know, there's some proof that it works. And I think empirically and clinically, we've shown that to be the case. Now, it's not simply the blocking enhancing opiate receptors in the brain. It's much more than that, the effects. It could be muscle relaxation, it could be opening up the blood flow. Inserting a needle down in a muscle that's cramped or really tight, that muscle is full of extra electrons that haven't been released because the muscle is surrounded by fascia, which form like insulating material around that muscle, so that if a message is sent to the muscle, then it can move discreetly versus all of them twitching at once. It's sort of like if you put your finger in a wall socket, your whole body would go like that.
Right.
Because that's overriding all the other insulation. But if you do the small amount that will go to a muscle, then that muscle contracts because there's an added electrical potential inside there. So an acupuncture needle going through the insulation, through the fascia, and into the muscle provides sort of a jumper cable influence of the ability of those electrons or the built up electricity to escape through the needle like a jumper cable would do and then into surrounding tissue, so the muscle has a chance to relax. Now that's not an opiate reaction. That's a pure electromagnetic field type of phenomenon.
Right.
So anyway, you know, to a certain degree, so some with respect to what does insurance cover, what is considered legitimate as far as acupuncture goes. There's pain syndromes. There's nausea with pregnancy.
Interesting.
And what else? There's something else recently that seemed to be kind of officially okay. Now, acupuncture is not recognized by Medicare.
Right.
So, but it is recognized by a lot of other plans as effective and cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there are patients I've seen who came in 25, 30 years ago and they were scheduled to have surgery, back surgery. And the acupuncture made things better. And so they may come, they'll call, oh, you know, I think I'm having some twitches or something. But so they'll come in and get a few treatments, and for them, that has prevented them from having to have a back surgery that could have potentially crippled them or caused a stiffening of their back and how it was done. And so what's the economic or the financial savings for that person? And how much better it has their life been not having had that surgery? I mean, how can you measure that money? I don't know.
Yeah.
But so, that's just an example of like, the insurance companies should realize the possible benefits of it. And yet, you know, there's the economics, you know, all surgeons have that. My uncle was a surgeon, he was a general surgeon. And when I was 18, I assisted him in numerous surgeries that summer. They weren't like back surgeries, but gallbladder resections and cancer resections and varicose veins, stripping, things like that. And so reducing the surgeries, back surgeries. If acupuncture could reduce that, it would save insurance companies significant money, but then surgeons wouldn't have as many surgeries to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's economic consequences of saving money one place and the other place doesn't get what it wants.
Do you think that there's any other, like, any other reasons why, like, it's not recognized as an economic benefit? Like, you said the back surgery is taken away from
the economics of having people take medication. Sometimes medications are cheaper than acupuncture treatments in the long run. If it's just like, you know, a dollar for a pill or something, and they take it once every 5 weeks, I mean, that's really cheap.
Yeah.
But generally that's not it. There's also consequences too to many of the medications. There's negative side effects on the liver, the kidneys, or other parts of the body. So thinking in the broader terms, there's also a lot of medication. People still, I mean, like I do watch broadcast TV,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know how long it's been that drug companies have been able to advertise their drugs again. There was a time period where they could say anything, and then I guess it's the FTC or whoever it is said, we're not going to allow any more commercials. And it was like 25 years that there were no drug commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And then the policy changed so that they have to say what the side effects are. So they're pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever watched them? Because the first 20 seconds of the 60-second commercial, whatever, is all about the benefits, and they have these great people running around having a great time. Wonderful. And then they start talking about the side effects, which are usually like two-thirds of the thing. And often the side effects are the same thing that is supposed to be helping.
Right.
That's always if you listen to it.
Yeah.
But if you look at the images, they are so clever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's happy faces going like this, and mm-hmm. you could die from this, and they're smiling. And it's like, what?
Yep.
You know, it's very interesting how that happens. Now, there's a lot of money obviously going to and advertising to promote those medications. So there are some powerful forces at stake. I mean, my father worked at Eli Lilly, which is a big pharmaceutical company in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And he died when I was 18. My mother got a pension from him till she died at 90.
Wow.
So, I mean, I have to thank them for that, being able to, you know, there's this divided kind of law. And there are medications that I think are positive, but there's others that are really junk,
mm-hmm.
you know, and are really damaging to people's bodies. So, that, I mean, who knows if that's part of why there's a stigma mm-hmm. on other things.
Right.
There was a statistic, I don't know how long ago it was, regarding the use of alternative medicines. Maybe there's been a new one done since, but this was a while back, and they were saying that for example, chiropractic, maybe 7 or 8% of the population used it, mm-hmm. and maybe 3% used acupuncture, or 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly has a very small percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. And so where that comes from, I mean, certainly when people come in for the first time, they have, many people have needle phobia, and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to have a conversation about the needles and show them what they look like. And so that's part of the natural stigma, mm-hmm. is needles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's also one of the things that we use to lobby the California Senate and the California Congress many, many years ago regarding the overuse. You know, that there's always this this fear that people are going to overuse something.
Right.
And so we're going, well, how many people want to go in and get stuck with needles just for fun?
Right.
I mean, people don't overdo that, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, but it is a barrier. So it's a stigma. Needles per se are a stigma. And it's a barrier as far as acupuncture goes.
Yeah. Yeah, but then like you were saying before, we use needles in biomedicine, and they're encouraged to, right? And there isn't really stigma attached to.
No, and those are much thicker and bigger and hurt more.
Yeah.
If it's done wrong. I mean, when I was very little, the nurse, the pediatrician that we went to, you know, she was going to give us shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, is it going to hurt? Mm-hmm. She said, yeah, it's going to hurt. She was honest. I love that. She said, it's going to hurt, but if you relax your muscle, it won't hurt as much.
Mm-hmm.
So just relax your arm, and it didn't hurt as much.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that candor, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes acupuncture needles, you don't even feel a thing going in. But other times, there may be a really tight muscle and the energy release is like, whoa, what was that?
Yeah.
One of my patients had this term called wasabi point. Whoa, that was a wasabi point. You know, it's like, if you've had wasabi, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. That's so funny. So, a question I would have for you is, in your journey to becoming a holistic practitioner, did you meet obstacles along your way?
There are obstacles. I mean, in this area, I was already when I came here. Then I got licensed, and so the licensure issue wasn't an issue. I don't think there were issues with getting business license either. There were a number of medical doctors who were supportive, and there were many who still aren't supportive at all.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some, you know, official obstacles, I guess.
Can you say a little bit more about that? If I'd
gone someplace and, you know, and said, you know, I want to refer people to you, and if you have people who might need my services, they can come in. They never refer a person. But there are others who are very supportive. So I don't know what the percentage of medical doctors are who are supportive of acupuncture. It's expanded, and there's certainly there's the issue of whether someone's an MD versus a non-MD practitioner. That's still a big thing in this society.
Mm-hmm.
So, in spite of the years of experience and training and things like that I have, if someone had the choice to go to MD versus me, they would often choose an MD who just took a weekend course.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're MDs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a cultural thing
mm-hmm.
that exists, I think, too. I mean, there are some people who say, I'll never go to an MD. They screwed up everything, you know.
Okay.
And so I'll never go to... But I think that's much fewer people than people who will say, well, I'll go to MD because they know what they're doing or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's that kind of cultural stigma that exists, I feel.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree, and I've heard a lot of that from other people
yeah.
as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In your journey as a holistic practitioner and becoming, do you feel supported in your work?
In what way? Yeah.
In sort of any way, from the larger community, it could be your patients, it could be the biomedical community, sort of.
There's like what the variety of things that I've learned and I practice. Acupuncture and homeopathic things and working with brain health using diet and nutrition and special supplements and things of that nature, exercise. I think there is, you know, I'm certainly supported by my patients. They mm-hmm. they like what I do. And family members do support. I don't treat my own family mostly
mm-hmm.
because they want to tell me what to do. And so it's like, who, do you know what it's like, you know, so there's certain times, like, there's a stigma, it's like, oh, I'll go to so-and-so, but will they, you know, they could ask my opinion, and that's fine. But I think that's also a good practice, not to necessarily treat your relatives. But there's, you know, there's other arenas. I think there is support and there's not support. It's a very interesting thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
For example, there's a homeopath I know whose sister has worked for like National Geographic or something like that. Very, very scientific, highly scientific person and very rational, and she thinks homeopathy is just totally garbage. Totally ridiculous. And the reality, if one has studied enough about homeopathy, where it originated, how it originated, and its effects, if you're a true scientist, I don't think you can just discard it. I don't think it's scientific to get rid of the possibility that it has some validity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Higher levels of science and string theory, things like that. I mean, you know, may actually help explain what's mm-hmm. going on, but most people don't know even what string theory is, let alone understand. I mean, I don't understand it that well, but I try to.
Right.
So there's certain explanations that may exist as far as why things work or how they work that are so beyond our comprehension right now that it's difficult for people to accept it based on just the mundane level of understanding most people have.
Right. Yeah, and then we come back to why certain, because there are things in biomedicine that are that way also, right? And why that is accepted when things like homeopathy aren't, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
But that's in this country. I mean, like homeopathy is very highly practiced in India, one of the places I studied and mm-hmm. used to treat people there. And at clinics, we had clinics where we do prescribing and stuff there. I think it's sort of this, I mean, to say this culture, it's such a mixed place here.
Yeah.
In the U.S.
That's true.
So, that's kind of what I have to say. But, you know.
So I would also ask do you, in your field, feel that your methods in your field is valued?
Just checking. Yeah. In the field? What do you mean?
Like your field of work.
Mm-hmm.
Is your field of work valued? Do you feel that your field of work is valued? So your methods and the work that you do as a practitioner.
I think there are people who value it,
mm-hmm.
and there are other people who don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the experience and the time and overhead in and of itself, you know, it's business. Mm-hmm. And so some people just go, oh, well, why should I pay this, you know? I'll just go. I mean, people can't get acupuncture on the internet. They can't just like log on
right.
and get treated vis-a-vis, I don't know, it'd be virtual something. I don't think it exists. Maybe it does. But some people immediately recognize the value, and other people go, I don't know, why would I pay for that?
Right.
So there's a difference in that region too.
So also, do you feel when, like, as you're building your practice, do you feel like you have a particular audience that you were sort of looking to attract in terms of patients, or was there any sort of method to that, or and I guess it kind of becomes a question of like marketing and things like that.
Yeah, there's a difference between treating people
mm-hmm.
and running a business.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're right. radically different. They're interrelated,
mm-hmm.
but you know there are lots of practice management gurus out there.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. some of whom actually had a practice that they built up, and then I think they left because they were tired of dealing with stuff. Mm-hmm. That's just my personal, I'm kind of cynical about it.
Yeah.
I'm a little cynical because I work with a number of different people like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of different approaches, just like in any other business. They'll say, oh, you need to focus, just, you know, have a narrow niche and you just focus this way. And then you create your niche.
Right.
You know, get known for a particular thing. And there are acupuncturists around who have done that. But what often occurs, though, is that someone will come in based on that particular specialty, mm-hmm. and then there will be other things that need to be addressed as well.
Right.
And then it spins off from that, too.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like you did focus more on a specialty, or were you...
When I started, no.
Attracting?
No.
No,
it was that.
Everyone.
It's yeah. you know, more recently I put attention into brain health. You saw my two books, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's something which I think is very important, because a third of the people in the U.S. will end up with dementia. Mm-hmm. One out of three people dies with dementia. One in six people are advancing is going to have Alzheimer's. And I think that's a much more multifaceted problem, because it has to do with toxicity, it has to do with blood sugar, it has to do with exercise, circulation. There are a lot of different reasons why, probably in combination, set people up for that. It's not simply genetics. There can be an epigenetic overlay where certain things in the environment turn the genes on or off. But I don't think it's simply genes, and even the Alzheimer's Association, when I last looked, said they thought it was multifaceted. So because people, I'd say the general population wants quick fixes. And they just want a silver bullet. When we talk in terms of it being more complicated than that, they turn off and they don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's a stigma or what it is. It's a mm-hmm. it's a mental construct of some sort where people, everyone would like things to go, like, you know, be instant millionaire, be, you know, whatever. But that doesn't tend to be the way things work.
Right.
And so if people are looking for just one little thing that's going to totally transform their lives, I don't know. I've seen a lot of multi-level marketing programs that are like that. And
right.
They promise the world, but it's like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
So, in reality, I think it's much more complicated, and it should be approached in that way to actually get good results.
Yeah.
And so there's a little stigma about, if it's a stigma, I don't know if it's a stigma, but...
I think it's definitely like a cultural thing, and I think that it's really around, for-profit businesses, and it's kind of this culture that comes out of the capitalist way of doing business that also produces a stigma, right? When you can't offer an instant gratification, right?
That's sort of how I see it. Ready to
shop? I guess I would just like to sort of, as like a wrap up kind of thing, ask sort of more directly, and I mean, you already said so much without me even having to ask the question, but maybe if there's something that you left out or didn't get to say enough about, what do you think about the stigmatization of alternative medicine, where it comes from, how it came to be? We've all obviously said so much.
Yeah, well,
already.
I think there's a tendency for people to want to just keep doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is outside of that realm, then it takes a while for someone to go, oh, I don't know, should I do this? And there's a little fear involved with that as well. So I think from on an individual level, often people have to get to a certain stage of desperation, mm-hmm. before they will try something that's outside what's considered mainstream. And so, whether that's a stigma or that's just human nature, or what, I don't know, mm-hmm. that's certainly one of the issues that people usually will act when they're forced to. Mm-hmm. There's a small percentage of people who act before that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why? So why do you think it would be considered outside the mainstream in the first place?
Alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. Well, it's called alternative medicine.
Right.
So that in and of itself, even language, mm-hmm. will make a difference. I mean, it's to say, well, even like, for example, acupuncture and Chinese medicine. I mean, acupuncture was one part of Chinese medicine in China. But I think it was really used much more by the royal families and stuff for a long time. And it was less so used by regular people. I mean, you know, just common person. At a point, they used silver and gold needles, and you know that was totally outside the economic possibility of most people there. So only the imperial family could use it. In many places in Asia, and they tell me, like I did in Japan, I read, write, and speak Japanese, I lived there for quite a while. And even now, they will say that even there, or in China, I met someone who's was a Cal graduate student, who's a landscape architect on the weekend. We were just trying to find some place that was open on Saturday morning. Everything didn't open until 11, but except Strata, so we went to Strata. We're just sitting there talking, and he was saying he grew up with all these herbs and things like that, but in China and elsewhere, Western medicine is like considered to be much more important. Mm. They put a much higher value on Western medicine than they do on the traditional.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I think fast results, there are many times where we get fast results with alternative medicine. And sometimes one visit, two visits, maybe three. Other times it takes a lot longer for chronic conditions that have been around for a long time or more complicated. So if someone comes in with the expectation that something's going to turn around like that, not even Western medicine does that all the time. I mean, certainly diabetes and arthritic conditions, things like that, people can still take a bunch of different kinds of medications and still not get relief they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And what they actually have to do is do something to totally cleanse their body, get chemical toxins out of the body, reduce the inflammatory cascades that are going on in order to make a lasting effect, versus just taking a pill that works in one little corner and doesn't deal with the underlying processes. But many people don't want to hear that. I mean, it is much easier just to take a pill.
Yeah,
if everything is like wonderful with the pill, then
right.
That's easy.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. I think just immediate gratification kind of is a underlying reason why there's stigmas to some things.
Yeah, interesting.
And if something isn't covered by insurance, or not fully covered by insurance, then you know, that's mm-hmm. another thing. It's like, well, insurance doesn't cover it. What's wrong with it?
Right. Trusting sort of the industry, right? Or, these entities that tell you what can be trusted and what can't.
I mean, it's like there's... I use Western medicine, too. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of testing and all kinds of other things that are really helpful. I don't discount it in all respects, but in some respects... there's shortcomings. Nothing is perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. The alternative medicine, whichever we're talking about. Some of those are miraculous. Like I was having some gallstone attacks once and we were ready to go to, I was leading a group to Japan. It was the day before we were leaving and it was just like doubling me over. It was horrible. And so I was thinking, what homeopathic remedy might work? So I called a veterinarian friend of mine. Mm-hmm. He said, Dave, what might I take? And he said, oh, well, you know, why don't you try this? So I went to my homeopathic pharmacy and I pulled out some things, a couple little pills, and bam, in like 5 minutes.
Wow.
And it didn't return. It's like,
wow.
That was the right remedy.
Yeah.
That was incredible. The, you know. So if it's exactly one, sometimes, you know, in homeopathy talking, there's exact remedy, and then there's ones that are sort of in the ballpark that are going to help, you know. But it's certainly, I mean, I've had positive personal experiences where that was instantaneous, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a Western med.
Right. Yeah.
But it's exactly, it's like, whoa!
Yeah.
Whoa! And, yeah. and you know, I'd gone through a whole other episodes of that gallstone stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And had them checked out with ultrasound, all these other things, the Kaiser and stuff. And so I had taken some other things to help clear out the liver and all. But when this came on so strongly and we were flying the next day, I was thinking, oh no, all this preparation, am I going to not be able to go?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like, that was dramatic. So I'm empirical,
mm-hmm.
you know. If something's going to work, you go, wow, that really worked.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I approach most things. And when people come in as patients, they might be skeptical. And I say, great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm skeptical too. I've seen this really help a lot of people, but not yet, all the time. So let's see if it's going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree completely. I've also had countless times, right, where whatever holistic remedy I used for whatever the problem was, you know, and it's amazing. And there's been times when your medical doctors haven't been able to help, and yeah, sometimes they do.
Yeah, and vice versa. I mean, you know, there's I certainly refer people out because there's a lot of things that may be going on that aren't being diagnosed by other practitioners.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't want somebody to not have something caught if it was caught. But
right.
There's also a bunch of people I've sent out and they couldn't find anything,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then later on we found something else, so.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Did we answer all your questions?
We did answer all my questions.
All right.
Yeah.
And more so. Good.
Yes.
All
yes.
Right.
So. Yeah, unless there's anything else that you...
No, this sounds great. So, I want to thank Monet for coming
today. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Being on the podcast.
Yeah.
And so, if you have more questions, there we'll have some information on the blog. So you can go to Natural Solutions with Dr. J and get information about Monet. And probably she's... on Facebook and other places, so you can you can follow her progression in life
yes.
and how things go in grad school.
Yes.
Are you already accepting grad school?
Well, I'm going to take a year and do some work in human services, and then next year do grad school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
To buy your copy of Superbrain, Maximize Your Brain Health for a Better Life, go to superbrain-thebook.com. That's superbrain-thebook.com. Information can also be found on naturalsolutionswithdrj.com.